Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, we're talking about making it big and then walking away. My guest, Kay, he made it on Wall Street, but he was living in fear. His blood pressure actually went up every time he got a notification on his BlackBerry.
You would kind of always know where the BlackBerry was in the room. And that red light would start to flash. It's like, who's going to yell at me? Who's going to tell me I suck? Like, what an awful way to live.
So he took a leap of faith.
I just kind of said, you know what? I can opt out of this game.
Did he make the right decision? Find out today on 50 Fires. Greetings, Carl here. Back in 2014, I read this crazy op-ed in the New York Times. The author was a Wall Street stock trader, and he opened the article with this line. In my last year on Wall Street, my bonus was $3.6 million, and I was angry because it wasn't enough. Now, here's the experience I had, right? I would imagine you're feeling the same way. Who on earth gets a $3.6 million bonus and is angry about it? Turns out the answer is all of us. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and recovering financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Kay Hee. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. My guest on today's episode, Kay Hee, can certainly relate to the author of that op-ed, because in 2015, at just the age of 35, a year after that article came out, he found himself looking around his New York office as a managing director at BlackRock and wondering what envy was starting to do to him. He noticed that almost everyone he hung out with believed that if they could just make another million or 10 million or 100 million in some cases, then finally they would be set for life and everything would be great. And he started to realize that in this environment, the idea of enough simply didn't exist. It was like a fairy tale or a story for children. It was never going to be enough. And frankly, more money wasn't going to make him happier. And so he quit. Let's go back to the New York Times op-ed for just a second. Because my friend Kay, he didn't write it. But it feels like he could have. Because the stock trader in that story, he came to the same crazy conclusion as Kay and left his job. Let me just emphasize that for a second. They both left their jobs. He now lives in Southern California with his wife and two daughters, where he spends his time surfing as much as he can and running Rad Reads, where he writes and coaches about our relationship to money, status, work, and time. And as he'll explain, this hasn't been the best financial decision, but it has made him exponentially more fulfilled and happy. Here's my conversation with Kay. Enjoy. Kay, if you had to summarize your beliefs around money early in your life in one word, what would it be?
Vigilance.
Vigilance is so interesting just because there's a sense of heightened awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Like situational awareness. Yep. Like I've always got to be on my guard.
And dude, I think about, you know, I've grinded through all of the enamels on my teeth. I teeter in and out of high hypertension. That stuff's in my body, man. Yeah, I remember in my Wall Street days, the thick brick BlackBerries.
Right.
And, you know, I was at investment banking. So there was, you know, you were working 7 days a week. And I would remember that it would be off of vibrate, but you would kind of always know where the BlackBerry was in the room. And then that red light would start to flash, indicating that you had a new message. And I would remember, like, my body. Like I'm feeling it now. It was that fight or flight. It was just like this wave of fear. It's like, who's going to yell at me? Who's going to tell me I suck? Who's going to tell me to come into the office right now? Who's going to make me stay up all night? Right. And it was just like, what an awful way to live.
Can you do me a favor for a second? Yeah. When you say I'm feeling it right now, what does it actually feel like?
Tightness in chest, shortness of breath. If you saw me in camera, I'm very small right now. Like my arms are crossed. My chest is kind of like caved inwards. Yeah, shallow breathing. I know that I feel the side of my neck.
But that's the same feeling as it felt with the red light flashing on the BlackBerry.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, elevated heart rate. I mean, I notice it now that I have an Apple Watch, but like even when I present for work stuff and it's stuff I've presented thousands of times, I'm not nervous, but like my heart rate's up. So there's probably some of that happening as well.
Do you remember the first time you held in your hands a large sum of money?
Having worked on Wall Street, where you literally know the day that it's going to hit, the bonus cycles are annual. And so you know the day, it's usually like February 12th or something.
Sort of bonus day, yeah. Yep.
The first one, I think my first bonus was like $17,000 or something. I'm like, oh my God, it just, you know, it was like $8,500 after taxes. But I'm like, what? This like four paychecks in one, you know, and like outside of the cycle. So that one was probably the most, you know, the first time you get a bonus. There was one year where the wire itself was seven figures. And I was like, oh my God.
And you remember that?
Oh yeah.
Hey, did you notice something going on in your head? And the reason I'm asking is because I did. As soon as Kay mentioned an amount of money, you know, a specific number, something went on in my head. I was trying to quickly make a judgment on whether this was even relevant to me anymore. Every single time in my column in the New York Times, I would mention a number, readers would naturally want to debate the value or the merit or the relevance because of the number, and they would miss the point. So if I could just humbly suggest whether that number that was just mentioned was insignificantly small or unsurmountably, unimaginably large, just maybe set that aside and focus on the principle we're talking about here. Because I found, independent of the size of the number, you know, the number of commas or decimal places, the principles still matter. How would you describe the feeling?
I mean, it's like in a rap video, man. Just like, yeah, I made it, dog. This like pride, but at the same time, like it's meant to be quiet in that culturally you're not meant to like run around and tell people how much money you made. But at the same time, that's where all the like virtue signaling kicks in after that. But no, I think for me, so much of it was you, Kay, have been committed to these financial goals from a very young age. And it was like older me telling younger me, like, I'm very proud of you. You did what you said you were going to do. And then I think a lot of the times I would actually look at it through the eyes of my parents. And I was just like, Mom and Dad, because of what you guys did, like in one bonus, I made more than you made in like 20 years of working. And I'm just like, thank you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Can you recall your earliest memory of money?
I'd have so many variations of money stories as kids, particularly because I was very entrepreneurial. But there's one that I really do remember. I was probably 10. So this was 1989. And we were living in New York City in Stuyvesant Town in the East Village by NYU. You know, at that point, we were probably middle class, lower middle class, middle class. And my dad had saved up a bunch of money to buy a printer. And so, you know, 1989, you know, like an HP inkjet, and, you know, those things are, you know, $600 in 1989 dollars. So my dad saves up for this printer. You know, it's just a good investment for the house, for my sister and I's schoolwork. And he comes home dejected looking. And I'm like, what happened? You know, because we knew he was getting the printer. And he was at our local subway station, 14th Street and First Avenue. And there weren't Metro cards then. So he's refilling his tokens. And someone swiped the printer and ran away.
Wow.
And I just remember, I'm like getting a little teary-eyed just thinking about it. As a kid, you just know that one hurt, right? And it was just a printer and no one was injured and all that, but you just knew that hurt.
Okay, how did you know?
I think just the word, like a shame, you know, like shame to it. My dad wouldn't give any tells. You know, he's a very traditional Asian man. But like, let's not wallow in our kind of dejection right now. And let's kind of pick ourselves up and just get on with what we need to get on with. Like an emotional self-stonewalling of sorts.
Yeah. Do you recall, I'm going to use the term in air quotes, but do you recall what social class you were in relative to other kids at your school?
Yeah, we lived in New York City arbitrage. So we lived an upper middle class life in New York City, but not because of what my parents earned as income, and definitely not what they came. They came to the country in the early 70s with like $1,000. And the reason why was my dad worked at the United Nations, and the United Nations has incredible employee benefits. And one of the benefits was that they would pay for 80% of your kid's school through the end of college.
Wow.
So, I mean, just think about that, right?
Yeah.
That right there is that can shift you in one entire strata, someone paying for your college. And we lived in Stuyvesantown. They still live where I was born, which is rent controlled.
Wow.
So they are living in a 900 square foot, 3-bedroom apartment, which is probably, they don't even tell me because we don't talk about this stuff that much. If I had to guess, it's like $2,000 a month rent, where the market value of that place is 10 grand. So they couldn't afford to live in New York City were it not for these indirect subsidies, I guess you could call them. And so we always kind of punched above our weight in socioeconomic standing plus the frugality.
Were you aware of that at school? Like, when's the first time you became aware of that at school?
I didn't realize the subsidy part until I was an adult. My school was a little bit strange because it was the United Nations International School. It's a very strange school because a lot of the kids there were international. And so we all kind of felt like middle class immigrant kids, basically. Thinking back in hindsight, I do remember there were kids who I would do kids' homework and they would like buy me jeans. So there were definitely kids that were walking around with $100 bills in their pocket in the 1990s, and I didn't get allowance. I got like $5 a week allowance maybe in my junior year of high school.
Wait, back up a minute. Did you say you did people's homework and they would buy you jeans?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I had so many hustles. At first, the status symbol in, this is a very Asian thing, but you go have lunch and then the Caucasian kids, the white kids, they're like buying lunch in the cafeteria. And then all the Asian kids, their moms pack them leftovers from the night before in like lunch boxes. I didn't want to be that stereotype kid, but I didn't have money to buy food in the cafeteria because I didn't have allowance. And so I would find ways to get allowance, which was doing people's homework to get cash.
I mean, do you recall not wanting to be one of those stereotypes? Like, do you recall the feeling of like, oh, those people are buying lunch and I'm eating out of this box?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were a few that I definitely recall was what you would eat for lunch and your clothes. I mean, New York being New York, in hindsight, it was super cool, but it's just a very fashion forward place to live. It was very much like Polo and Calvin Klein. You know, I had fake Polo shirts that we bought in Chinatown. It's not that they know that it's fake because it looks fake. They know that it's fake because they know you can't afford it.
Fascinating.
I do remember we would buy fake stuff in Chinatown and on trips. The fake stuff outside the US was higher quality fakes than the Chinatown fakes, the New York Chinatown fakes. You know, we would splurge on TJ Maxx and, you know, where they dump the inventory stores. So that would be the treat, would be like, oh, you could get, you know, a polo shirt from, you know, 4 years ago with a giant horse when everyone only wears the tiny horse, but you could get it for $20 instead of $60.
The good old giant horse.
Yep, the good old giant horse. So
do you remember them, your parents, talking about money much in the house? Or was it just this feeling?
I mean, I think there was always talk about like how much we could and should save, right? So we weren't necessarily talking about money, but we were talking about saving, not even investing, saving. And then there was always the assessment of, you know, this thing's too expensive, right? That's too expensive. A very distinct memory was coupons. They're always coupons. Like getting a deal on something made you enjoy it more, right? I don't have that anymore. My mom still has it. You know, I buy her nice skin lotions and anti-aging creams for Mother's Day and her birthday. And she's like, how much did this cost? And was it on sale? And she like, there are times when she's fought me for the receipt to go get some coupon that, this was especially the case for Kiehl's, because some of your listeners might know this. Kiehl's would send a 20% discount coupon every 3 days in your mail. So basically anything at Kiehl's was always meant to be 20% cheaper. And so my mom had a stack. I mean, this is like 10 years ago, in the past 10 years. She had a stack of Kiehl's coupons. So I'd buy a nice Kiehl's thing, and I'm just, you know, the busy, lazy, you know, some semi-entitled, quote-unquote rich, you know, urban guy. And I'm like, I don't have time to find a coupon. Just buy the thing. And she would take the coupon and the gift back to just price adjust it back to my card.
Right, retroactively.
Exactly, with the 20%.
Right. So good. 50 Fires, we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid, and credit card versus debit card, which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. Okay. Was there any spiritual or religious traditions that informed money at an early age?
Absolutely none. I personally identified as an atheist. You know, basically as soon as I could learn that term, we grew up totally secular. Yeah, there was very little. There was no religion and not much spirituality in our household.
Yeah, any cultural, like, timeless wisdom, like you mentioned a family lore from your own life, but anything else passed on from generations past that you heard repeatedly?
So my dad grew up in Cambodia, kind of poor-ish, and we would hear the stories about him being forced to eat every single piece of food on their plate. And it's funny now because my wife is very much in the world of wellness, and my wife had different body image type stuff. My wife, Lisa, is American. And to her, one of the most harmful things you can do to a kid is to force them to eat when they're not hungry. So it's just funny because my kids will go with their grandparents for a sleepover, and you know, they're getting older now. And like, I don't want to, like, they make us eat all our food on the plate, every piece of rice. And I struggle to throw out food.
What do you make of that?
That message was pounded into my head for so long that it kind of metastasizes into your kind of worldview. Right. And I think it's more than food, right? It's like being wasteful. Being wasteful in general, right? I still see that show up. And you and I have talked a lot about kind of scarcity and kind of the fear of losing it all, the fear of losing it, the fear of it being taken away from you, rightfully, wrongfully. I do think that not being okay with wastefulness is a byproduct of that lingering scarcity. Right? They're bedfellows.
Which at some point back in the generations served the people really well. Like, that was an important thing. It's almost epigenetic because there's some version of that floating around everywhere, it feels like. But it was always, for me, it was always finish your food because there's somebody somewhere else who's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that my community I grew up with saying, finish your food because there's somebody somewhere else that's hungry. And there's somebody somewhere else saying, hey, finish every bite of your food because we may be hungry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like, in that, both sides of that equation are passing that down.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point they serve the purpose. And I think, like so many things around scarcity and money, we're almost genetically responding to something that at one point was really important, but no longer is serving us.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the, like, what's the short version of making the decision to pull the plug and move across the country, surf every day, like that whole dream? What was the short version of that?
So there were two steps because they didn't both happen at the same time. The first step was leaving Wall Street. And then the second step was kind of getting enough traction as an entrepreneur to be location independent, you know, pre-COVID. So with leaving finance, I think it was the hedonic treadmill, right? You know, I call it the when-then trap, which is, you know, once I have seven figures in the bank, then I'll be happy. Once I own an apartment in New York, then I'll be happy. Once I'm a managing director, then I'll be happy. And, you know, there's many advantages to having success at a relatively young age. But for me, the biggest advantage was that it taught me that success, at least in that traditional sense, that wasn't the game. And kudos to some divine intervention that, you know, made me question it and really made me look deeply inside every time those things happen. Like, wait a minute. Like, I thought that when I bought an apartment in New York, that was the definition of your life's complete. Right. And I don't want to take away. That's a very difficult thing to do and not available to many different people and lots of things that worked in my favor in that. It was nice, but it wasn't it.
Right. It wasn't.
It was not it. That's for dang sure. It was not it. And I had been counting the days since I was a 12-year-old for these events to happen. But, you know, after 3, 4, 5 times of this is not it, I said, okay, have you ever considered that this isn't the playbook? And I think that was really, the seed was planted. What's that Mark Twain quote? It's like the definition of insane is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Right, yeah.
So I kind of had that. I didn't know that quote at the time. I just kind of said, you know what? I can opt out of this game. You know, I get that this is a big game. It's a big game for many people. It's an important game for many people. But man, I'm 35 years old. I can opt out of this. Please tell me there's something other than this game out there for me.
And are you still super stoked about the California move and being there and your life and all the changes you made?
Yeah. I mean, life's pretty incredible. You know, my daughter was asking me earlier, she said, would you rather learn how to make video games from scratch or go back to working at BlackRock? Well, I was like, I never want to go back to work at BlackRock.
Right, right.
But it's an interesting point in life to be, because I'm a relatively newish father, but I've been off the grind for 8 years now.
How old are your kids?
My eldest just turned 9 and my youngest is 5. And there's so many incredible things. I mean, mostly just like being able to watch my kids grow up and be intimately a part of their lives in things big and small, especially in this kind of magical window now where my wife and I are still number one for them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there is this pondering about, you know, am I doing enough? Am I achieving my potential? Am I leaving cards on the table? This kind of second guessing around, am I where I'm supposed to be? And I know that I am, but I can't help but look at something very, very basic, which is my net worth hasn't changed in 8 years. Which I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Well, that's
not
true.
Well, apparently you did.
No, that's not true. I know that it doesn't matter, but I can't help but think like, wow, if I had stayed at BlackRock, it would be like triple what it is. That, I mean, those were straight up peak earning years, right? Yeah. Managing director, 35 to 43, kind of full health, full energy. But then I immediately go back, like, if I had 3 times as much money in my bank account, I would literally do the exact same thing I'm doing right now.
Financially, what does enough mean to you?
Oh God, that's such a, there's so much there. The impulsive answer, which is not worrying about money. Right. So that's the first, the impulsive one. It's just like, I want to never worry about it. Right. Stock market goes down 20%. Don't worry. Unexpected furnace goes out $2,000 here. Don't worry. Like that is, you know, don't get that contract you thought you were going to get. Don't worry. Cause like one day I decided 2 years ago, I was like, I'm never going to worry about money. I just like said that to myself.
Right. Right. Right.
And I started to just act that way. And, you know, we don't spend like crazy, but, you know, there's definitely things where different decisions make me worry, right? Are we going to, you know, go on this vacation, or are we going to upgrade this car or do that? Like,
if it's not worry, is there a number associated with that not worry?
Yeah.
And if your net worth was triple and it wouldn't change, then the answer probably is it's not a number.
You know, a friend of mine just pocketed $50 million from a sale of his company. And he was a worrier like me. And he's like, you know what, Kay, I don't really worry anymore. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I don't buy that, to be honest. Like, you know what I mean? Given once the money's invested, once the money, like it's not a destination. There is no number.
Because as you know, even then you lose $50 million in the stock market and you lose 30%, like that's $15 million. Yeah, you know, the absolute, you start to worry even though you still have 35. So you definitely worry less, but I don't think that there is a number that would make me not worry. But here's the thing that I've really started to piece together about myself, and you've seen me tweet and write about this, is that money is one of my own measures for myself of my self-worth. Mm. It's not the only one. And it doesn't have the grip on my self-worth that it had in my 20s and in my early 30s, but it's definitely still there. And so really, the money thing is, it's a sense of self-question. I could take it a step further. That part comes from a sense of conditional self-acceptance that I have for myself. Right? It's like, you're a better person, Kay, this is the internal monologue, if you write something that 50,000 people enjoy than if 5 people enjoy it. And so money is kind of like it's the fuel and the exhaust of all of those systems, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because that's one of the things I wanted you to respond to, is just this statement, how much I earn as an individual is an indication of my value.
Yeah. The head knows that it's not true. but the heart won't accept it. Some people say it the opposite way, but that's the way I feel it. I ask people, would you rather have five people at your funeral or 5,000? And most people, they'll kind of hedge, like, ah, it doesn't matter, I won't be there. But when push comes to shove, there's a comfort in knowing that 5,000 people cared about you in some way, shape, or form versus five, even though 4,995 of them could be Craigslist volunteers that someone paid to attend your funeral, and five could be your nuclear family, right? And I think this is a very Western way of seeing the world, that like everything has some kind of value assigned to it.
Those are pointing at very different things though, which is super interesting, right? Like one is a sense of community, a relationship, a tribe, and the other is a number on a page or an amount in a bank account.
It's funny. When I think 5,000, I don't see the tribe. It's just a number.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that the idea that back to where this started with enough, I don't think enough is a destination that you can arrive at. It's a thing that you can be. And that sure, some number in a bank account could establish conditions under which enoughness might be easier, maybe, but it's not. And we know that to be true because you and I both know people with more money than they'll ever need, ever, 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 that are not enough. And we both know people who have nothing that have enough.
Yeah.
And that if you're, you know, I'm using this term really loosely and largely as it applies to me, but if you're psychotic around money, more money won't solve the problem, right? Yep. It's a different set of work, which is what you're pointing to. Like it's upstream.
Yes. I have a test, which is if a rich benefactor just magically wired me $1 billion into my bank account last night, what would my day today look like knowing that I had that money in the bank account? And I want the day to be as close to the day that I am having today. You know, I rolled around with my kids. We made pancakes this morning and I'm going to go work out. I couldn't surf today. I'm, you know, $1 billion can't create waves. So I'm subject to Mother Nature there. But if Mother Nature had blessed us with waves this morning, I would have surfed for 2 hours. My blood pressure read low this morning. I might have a drink this afternoon because it's Monday and I'm on vacation. One thing I would add to that is a choice of who I get to spend my time with. In business and in life, right? In life, obviously, you have outside of your family, you have more of a choice. But in business, if someone's like, I'm an a-hole, but I'll pay you 3x, you're going right. So the ability to say no, to me, that's being happy about your money.
Just one last question. It's January 2050, so 27 years from now. Your two kids are 36 and 32. And I'm interviewing them for this podcast, and you're listening to it. What do you hope they're saying about their relationship with money?
I hope that they had to figure out their own path about it. I can't dictate the experiences that will have shaped that relationship. Like any relationship, right? There's the puppy dog years and the tumultuous ones and the second guessing and the anger and the frustration. Like, I hope that they talk about like, God, it was so crappy, that studio we lived in, you know, downtown LA, because we didn't have any money, but it didn't matter because we were going out and we all, you know, 12 of us lived together. Like, I hope that they have allowed themselves to experience all of the emotions that come with money, because it is such a, it's such a big part of our society that I don't think you can just like arrive at a point of wisdom. And I think kind of like the number or enough, you know, I hope that they kind of meander through that dance and really get to feel all the feels for it and come out wiser from it, right? Like, I hope they make stupid money decisions. I hope they don't make a lot of them, but I hope they make stupid money decisions so that they understand what a stupid money decision feels like. I wouldn't want to be listening to the podcast and be like, my dad said that I was going to be a pilot and now I'm a pilot, right? Just like I don't want them to say like, my dad said I should never worry about money and here I am not worrying about money, right? It's like, no, I want you to worry about money, not too much, right? But I would hope that they get to experience both of those coins.
Listen, I don't know if you were left with the feeling I had after listening to the Kay story, really thinking about what it would mean in my own life to have enough. It turns out that enough is kind of crazy. The concept is crazy because enough is not a number. Enough is not a destination. Enough is not a place that you can arrive. Enough is something that you have to be. So as we wrap up here, let's pretend just for a second that you and I are sitting around a fire, and it's your chance to tell me your own story by answering the following questions. What does money mean to you? What would it mean to have enough? Is there even such thing as enough money? It can be super scary to think too long about these questions of money and meaning, but maybe, just maybe, if we're willing to do it together, if we're willing to set aside shame or blame, embarrassment or fear, maybe we can make this conversation a little less scary. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks for joining me today. And I look forward to talking a lot more with you in the future. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio. If you find this show valuable, would you do me a favor? Share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.